The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jim Cronin from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from the Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Okay, let's start off with something kind of suitable to the new year. Find your new favorite hobby. Have more fun, learn new things. These aren't bad New Year's resolutions. Here's how to get started. Kate Hanselman's home is a shrine to hobbies past and present. Fencing gear sits beside multiple pairs of rock climbing shoes. I find yarn everywhere because I love knitting, and I have a whole set of embroidery stuff, she says, plus stacks of puzzles, her partner's golf clubs, and equipment from his flying lessons. Our house is like a full hobby station, she says with a laugh. Challenging, fun, and engaging hobbies have the power to make us happier and healthy, says Hanselman, a nurse practitioner with the counseling practice ThriveWorks. Such pursuits help us grow in creative, physical, intellectual ways and can boost self-esteem. Plus, they often foster connection with others. Hobbies lead to better physical health, more sleep, lower stress, greater life satisfaction, a larger social network, and improved work performance. Hobbies live in the pleasure world, not necessarily the mastery world, Hanselman says. We're not trying to impress the board. We're not going for a paycheck. There's no ulterior motive. Hobbies are like dessert, and as a baker myself, dessert is the most important part of the meal. That resonates with Griff Johnson, recreational woodworker, motorcyclist, gardener, cook, and runner. He's accepted that he'll never be a master surfer, but that doesn't dampen his enjoyment of riding waves. He's so taken with beekeeping that his backyard is now home to 20,000 honeybees. I really love learning and figuring things out, and developing an understanding of how things tick, says Johnson of Carolina Beach, North Carolina. We know where that is. His hobbies tend to involve out of curiosity, boredom, or need. Take the bees. After moving into a new home with a barren yard, he was concerned about the lack of pollinators, so he planted a garden and became a beekeeper. If you derive joy from your hobby, it doesn't matter if it's a board game or beekeeping. I'm confident it will make you a better person in every aspect of your life. But where do you start? We ask experts how to discover the hobbies you don't yet know you'll love. Sorry about that. That's worded kind of funny. Ask yourself how you want to feel. Hobbies prevent an escape. They can help you get out of your head. Calm down, says Matthew Zadowski, an associate professor of health psychology at the University of California, Merced, who has researched connections between leisure and well-being. He suggests asking yourself how you want an activity to make you feel. Mentally engaged, distracted, relaxed, socially connected? It's also helpful to consider what your life is missing, like creativity or physical activity. Recognize that you have different needs at different moments, and that's okay, he says. There's no such thing as one perfect hobby. Start small. Don't invest a ton of time and money in a new hobby immediately. Ease into it to figure out if it's right for you, advises Rebecca Weller, a mental health counselor specializing in career counseling. You can always do more later, she says. If you wonder if paintballing might be a good fit, join an outing or two with a local meetup group, or sign up for a one-night, one-time pottery class rather than a set of eight. It's also smart to resist the pressure to overcommit. Hanselman enjoys learning defense, but the next step was competing. And she didn't want to do that, so she stopped. You spend enough of your day pushing yourself, she says. Hobbies are supposed to be fun. Be open. Keeping an open mind and not dismissing potential hobbies, even if they seem out of your wheelhouse, is key, says Katina Baja, a clinical psychology researcher and co-founder of Daydreamers, a company that helps adults tap into their imagination, creativity, and curiosity. She and her husband recently went hiking in San Francisco, where they live, and someone handed them a pamphlet of plants to look for along the trail, such as miner's lettuce. Instead of tossing it, they paid attention, and now they have a new hobby, foraging. We're wired as humans to be curious and open, but in a very burned-out world, we often forget that, she says. It's the first thing to go. So next time someone hands you a flyer or invites you to tag along at an event, seize the opportunity. It can introduce you to some things you never guessed you'd love. Take a trip back in time. When you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up? The answer could point you toward an appealing hobby, Wheeler says. If you want to be a major league player, what can you do now that fulfills that urge for you, she asks. Joining a softball team or coaching some neighborhood kids could reignite a long dormant passion. The nostalgia doesn't have to stop there. Revisit activities you loved when you were young, Baja suggests, like drawing, putting together model kits, collecting things, or building clay figures. It's really a helpful place to start and allows you to feel comfortable, she says. Childhood delights can easily evolve into adult hobbies. Go back to school. Considering auditing a class at a university or signing up for a lesson to learn more about a potential hobby, Wheeler advises. Always dreamed of writing a novel? Join a fiction writers group. Fascinated by family history? Take a genealogy class. Plenty of e-courses are available free or for a nominal price. Take an assessment. Lots of colleges offer career assessments to help students determine what to major in and how to navigate their professional lives. You can also use these tools to glean insight into potential hobbies, especially for those where you're starting from square one, Wheeler says. If you're a college graduate, connect with your university's alumni center. Sometimes they make these assessments available for free, or you can pay a career counselor for access. Keep a list. Hanselman and her partner keep a running list in their fridge of all the things that strike them as interesting. Maybe a month from now, I'll be like, butterfly garden. Why did I think that was a good idea? Or it just might be the right time for it, she says. Log potential interests as they come to you, and you'll have no shortage of options to explore when you're ready. Remove guilt from the equation. Zawadowski's research indicates that when people feel guilty about spending time on leisure, they experience increased symptoms of depression and anxiety. Give yourself permission to do something like you like, he urges, and keep in mind that if a hobby makes you healthier and happier, everyone around you will benefit. Think of discovering new hobbies as an adventure that will add fulfilling new dimensions to your life and enjoy the process. I sneakingly suspect that we have more leisure and hobbies in us than we realize, he says. Still Laughing. George Slater worked with everyone in Hollywood. In his new book, Still Laughing, A Life in Comedy, Unnamed Press, the producer of Laugh-In, Real People, and a slew of TV specials dishes on all of them. Like the time Dean Martin and his wife threw a party only to see Dino repair to his bedroom early. An hour later, a knock at the door. It was the cops responding to a noise complaint from a neighbor. The upset neighbor was Martin, trying to clear the house of guests. Another time, famed comedian Henny, take my wife, please, young man, begged Schlatter to own him and his family in a deli. Schlatter was busy, but he went. And sure enough, there was Henny and 11 people having lunch, writes Schlatter. He ordered a Coke, chatted with the family, and left feeling glad that I had made an old man like Henny happy by saying hello to his family. 2 days later, I got a bill for the lunch with an enormous tip for the waiter. Henny had signed my name. I called him, Henny, it's bad enough that I paid for this lunch, but what about this tip? Henny said, George, I didn't want you to look cheap. All right, folks, we're going to have a little change here because, as you well know, and I mentioned it before, the Reader's Digest has gone to only doing 9 or 10 issues a year. And so the December-January issue has basically been exhausted by us. So we're going to do something else from the Reader's Digest. It's called Read Up. It's basically they send out little articles and different things of interest to us. And so we'll probably bounce around on those and read some of those. I'm reading from my computer. Thank goodness for that. And anyway, some of the things are pretty interesting, so I think we'll find it fills the time up quite well. 12 Etiquette Mistakes Everyone Makes at Italian Restaurants. Eating bread with your pasta? That's just one of the surprising Italian restaurant etiquette mistakes you should avoid. Italian Restaurant Etiquette Mistakes You Need to Know. Whether it's your favorite family-owned restaurant or a beloved chain, firstly, everyone has an Italian restaurant go-to. Italian food has become such a part of how many Americans eat that it's almost impossible to imagine a life without pizza, pasta, and gelato. But in the end, it's just food. And it doesn't really matter how you eat it, right? Not exactly. Chances are you're making some Italian restaurant etiquette mistakes without even realizing it. Most people assume there's a general set of etiquette rules that apply no matter where you eat. And that's true to an extent. After all, no matter what restaurant you're in, it's considered rude to chew with your mouth open or pay more attention to your phone than your dining companions. But just like there are certain etiquette rules specific to steakhouses, There are a whole other set of etiquette rules you should be following in Italian restaurants, including the right way to eat pasta. Seriously, does anyone know how to eat spaghetti the right way? We ask etiquette gurus and Italian restaurant specialists to dish on the do's and don'ts of Italian restaurant etiquette, including the right way to eat pasta. We asked etiquette gurus, I'm sorry, the computer just flashed up an ad. I hate when it does that. We ask etiquette gurus and Italian restaurant specialists to dish on the do's and don'ts of Italian restaurant etiquette. From the subtle missteps and outright rude restaurant behavior, you should avoid to the polite habits restaurant staffers secretly dislike. Here's what you wish you knew. Cutting spaghetti. There's one Italian restaurant etiquette mistake many Americans make. It's cutting their pasta. According to Italian etiquette, spaghetti and fettuccine should not be cut with a knife into smaller pieces, says Albert Pasuti, a specialist in Italian and international hospitality codes of behavior, who regularly holds training courses in Italy. Italian etiquette expert Elisa Moratelli agrees, adding that it's considered improper to use a spoon to torture pasta. You should only use the fork to swirl your spaghetti, she says. If that's the case, how come Italian restaurants often offer a big spoon with your spaghetti? What to do instead? According to both Pasuti and Moratelli, the proper way to eat spaghetti or fettuccine is to use your fork to twirl it. You should be able to twirl it into bite-sized nests with no stray ends lifted to your mouth, Moretti says. However, she does acknowledge that this can be tricky to master. So if you're really struggling to get just the proper amount on your fork to twirl, go ahead and use your spoon for an assist. Using your knife to cut lasagna. Oh, it's just like it's considered rude to cut spaghetti or fettuccine. Moratelli says it's also proper to use a fork and knife to cut stuffed pasta, like lasagna, stuffed shells, or ravioli. This one could leave some Americans baffled, left to stare at their layered lasagna, wondering about the best way to dig in. But Italians value pasta so much that they would never cut a knife to it. It should be treated with respect. That is why it's considered bad dining etiquette to use a knife on any type of pasta. What to do instead? Fortunately, you can still cut Italian stuffed pasta without breaking any etiquette rules. You just have to use your fork instead of your knife. Moratelli says that the best way to do it is to cut the pasta with the side of the fork. And while you're at it, make sure it's an appropriately sized piece you can easily fit into your mouth. Eating bread with pasta. There's nothing like warm, crusty Italian bread. But there's a right time and a wrong time to eat it. If you ask the waiter for a basket of bread to go with your pasta, that would be the latter. According to Moratelli, bread should not be eaten with other starchy foods like risotto or pasta. And check out this interesting food fact. Pasuti says garlic bread and buttered breadsticks are not commonly served in Italy. These are American foods, not Italian. Who knew? What to do instead? If you go to an Italian restaurant and a bread basket is placed on the table, eat it with your super salad, says etiquette expert Jules Martinez Hurst, co-author of The Power of Civility. Or if you order an entree that isn't starch-based, you can also enjoy your bread along with the main course. Using bread to soak up pasta sauce. All that delicious sauce. Of course you want to get every last bit of it until your plate is completely clean. But if you're using bread to soak up sauce at a fancy restaurant, you may raise some eyebrows. Using a small piece of bread to wipe away any leftover sauce on your plate is a common gesture in a casual setting, but it's considered very casual, so avoid it in a more formal setting, Moratelli says, of this surprising Italian restaurant etiquette mistake. What to do instead? If it's spaghetti night at home or you're heading to a chain restaurant like Olive Garden, go ahead and use your bread to enjoy every last drop of your sauce. But if you're eating somewhere nice, it's better etiquette to savor the sauce while you enjoy your pasta and leave any remaining on your plate. Dipping your bread in communal olive oil. At Italian restaurants, it's common for the waiter to put a basket of bread on the table for everyone to share, along with olive oil for dipping and, depending on the restaurant, butter. Hurst says to resist dipping your bread into communal olive oil or putting your knife into communal butter and then spreading it on your bread. Both are considered bad form. What to do instead? If you want to enjoy olive oil with your bread, Hurst says pour some onto your personal bread plate instead of dipping your bread into the mini bowl of olive oil. For butter, Use your knife to get a small serving of butter and put it on your bread plate. Then use your knife to spread the butter from your plate on your bread. No, this isn't an etiquette mistake most people dislike or would even notice, but it is something that will make you look like a novice at your favorite Italian restaurant. Passing food to the left. If you're eating at a family-style Italian meal or everyone is sharing an appetizer, it's important to make sure you're passing the food the right way. Otherwise, it causes confusion, and perhaps even worse, someone may miss out on enjoying something delicious. According to Mortarelli, passing food to the left is considered a minor etiquette mistake, not just at Italian restaurants, but at mealtime in general. Keep this in mind at dinner parties, too. What to do instead? Pass food to the right. Take only what you believe you will eat so you don't waste food. This is especially the case when it comes to bread. Bread should never be wasted, Mortarelli says. One should always finish their individual portion of bread. Remember, Italians treat their bread and pasta very dearly. Choosing the right wine. Wine is a big part of Italian culture, but deciding which wine to order with your meal can be intimidating. Here, you can relax. According to chef Francesco Basile, Sicilian board executive chef and owner of San Diego's Adatica Trattoria, it's more important to get what you will truly enjoy than to play by any wine pairing rules. In fact, he says, both red and white wines can go with pasta with red sauces, pasta with white sauces, or seafood dishes. What's most important is you enjoy your meal, and you're much more likely to do that if you like your wine. What to do instead? Instead of ordering a wine that you think is the right one to pick, go with what you tend to like or what you're in the mood for that night. Better yet, ask for a recommendation telling the sommelier that what you're looking for. It's an especially good idea to find out if there are any local and seasonal wines to try from some of the best wines in Napa Valley, Long Island, Oregon, or, yes, Italy. If you don't ask, you might be missing out on a wine that become your new favorite. Another thing to think about, all the flavors in the dishes you'll be enjoying and what notes might complement them. For example, if you're ordering pasta with red sauce, it's not just about the tomatoes. It's also about the herbs in the sauce, too, says Cali Martinez, the owner and wine educator at Alto Vino in San Francisco. Do you want something spicy to pair it with? Something citrusy and freshy? Once you determine what you're after, you can ask your waiter or sommelier to point you in the right direction. Ordering pasta as a side. There's a reason Italian restaurants don't list pasta under side dishes. They are meant to be entrees. Pasta should never be ordered as a side, Mortarelli says. If you want both a salad and pasta but are trying to be calorie conscious, don't ask the waiter if you can get pasta as a side and a salad for your main meal. They are listed on the menu in appropriate spots for a reason. What to do instead? If you want pasta but don't think you will eat a full entree serving, eat what you like and ask the waiter if you can get your leftovers to go. None of the etiquette experts say that asking your leftovers to go is considered rude, even at a fancy restaurant. On the contrary, it's good that the food is not going to waste. Adding shredded Parmesan to seafood dishes. Curious if asking for more cheese is rude? Prosciutto and Mortarelli says it isn't, but it does matter what you want to put it on. Italians love to sprinkle of Parmesan on pasta, especially on spaghetti and fettuccine, Prosciutto says. Even in restaurants, Parmesan is brought to the table in the cheese bowl, so you can use it in the quantity you need. But Mortarelli explains that it's not meant to be used in anything with seafood, such as spaghetti with clams. It takes away from how the dish is supposed to taste. What to do instead? If your meal is seafood-free, go ahead and ask for shredded Parmesan if you want. Asking for extra Parmesan is not rude as long as you do not overuse the cheese, Mortarelli says. Parmesan has a strong flavor and might conceal other flavors in your dish. While it's a definite Italian restaurant etiquette mistake to add cheese to a seafood dish, it's okay to add salt and pepper, if you'd like. This is because these ingredients are very likely already incorporated into your seafood dish, unlike cheese. Making the waiter wonder if you're done eating. Italians love to enjoy a leisurely meal, and this is the one great joys of traveling to Italy. That said, when you're finished eating your meal in Europe or the States, there is a proper way to subtly alert the waiter so they aren't left guessing whether they should clear your plate. Putting your utensils on the tablecloth or on your napkin or using them to create an X on your plate are all wrong ways to do it. Putting your napkin on top of your plate is also considered rude. What to do instead? To indicate that you are finished eating, Hirsch says, to place your knife and fork diagonally across the plate. If you imagine your plate being cockfraised, the end of the fork and knife should both be at 4 and 5, while the sharp ends are at 10 and 11. As for your napkin, place it to the left of your plate when you're finished eating. And whatever you do, don't put it on your plate, because this makes a complete mess, both for the person cleaning your table and the fun for those who need to launder the napkins. Hershey's, these rules apply to all restaurants, not Italian ones. Getting a cappuccino with your main course. Ouch. Yes, cappuccinos are popular in Italy, but Prosciutti says that they aren't typically sipped with an Italian dinner. Cappuccinos are drunk during breakfast, says Monter, he says. Montarelli agrees. Cappuccinos are more of a snack in our view, so it's okay to have one in the morning, maybe with a croissant. Some people might enjoy it mid-afternoon as a pick-me-up, but we never eat a proper meal while sipping cappuccino. Here in America, however, it isn't uncommon to see cappuccinos on the menu at an Italian restaurant. But don't order one with your dinner. What to do instead? If you want to have a cappuccino, wait until dessert. The flavors will pair much better with sweet treats to avoid savory entries anyway. Tucking your napkin into your shirt. When you're about to join a big plate of spaghetti with red sauce, it's natural to want to protect your clothing. Tomato stains are no joke. But Hirsch says it's considered rude to tuck your napkin into your shirt. What to do instead? Be careful and place your napkin on your lap. If you stick one of the other etiquette rules about how to eat your meal, especially pasta, the right way, it's unlucky that you'll be getting anything for your meal on your shirt. Chances are you're not just making a mistake when dining out. Now that you know the top Italian restaurant etiquette mistakes to avoid, find out the white habits that dinner party guests secretly dislike. Now from the healthy portion. Women's autoimmune diseases. Doctors share three reasons they're so common. One out of every ten people, one has an immune system that tracks their own body. And 80% of those are women. Why? We got answers. Chronic pain, insomnia, joint pain, rashes, and gastrointestinal issues. Severe allergy, hair loss, brain fog, and fatigue are just a few of the debilitating symptoms that Amy Paulson, a 40-year-old mom of two, struggles with daily. It impacts every aspect of her life, limiting what she could do, forcing her to eat a very precise diet, and take a handful of supplements and medications. But the most difficult part to live with? No one can tell me what's happening to me, she tells the Healthy Reader's Digest. I spent thousands of dollars, done every test imaginable, and spent so much time seeing doctors and researching, and I still don't know what's wrong with me. And if we don't know what's wrong, we can't fix it, which is super depressing. While she received many diagnoses over the years, including inflammatory arthritis and fibromyalgia, all Paulson's doctors know for sure is that her conditions are autoimmune in nature, meaning that her symptoms are a result of her immune system going into hyperdrive and attacking her own body. Paulson isn't alone, far from it. How common are autoimmune diseases in women? Nearly 1 in 10 people worldwide suffer from some type of autoimmune disease. But perhaps a really alarming statistic is that nearly 80% of those sufferers are women. Autoimmune disorders occur when the body's immune system creates autoantibodies that mistakes the body's own healthy cells as intruders and attacks them. It's an umbrella term for about 80 diseases, including type 1 diabetes, multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, celiac disease, Crohn's disease, and Hashimoto's thyroid disease. And they all affect women at a much higher rate than men. This is why all the women need to know the silent signs of lupus. These diseases range from debilitating to disabling to, in some cases, terminal. This makes it extremely important to figure out who, what, and why behind them and how to treat them, says H. Michael Shepard, Ph.D., bio-oncologist and autoimmune disease researcher and founder of Enosi Life Sciences, a research and development company for therapeutics for autoimmune diseases and cancer. We know that women are far more likely than men to suffer from multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and other autoimmune disorders, says Dr. Shepard, who invented Herceptin, trazimuzumab zombie, a drug that fights HER2+ breast cancer by targeting the immune system. But why is the million-dollar question? It starts with, why are autoimmune diseases higher in women? It starts with sex differences in the immune system, Dr. Shepard explains. that women and both have the same immune system. However, women's immune systems are more responsive, producing a more vigorous immune response to their environment, and have a higher antibody production than men. However, he adds, when men do get autoimmune diseases, they are often more severe. He says this is one of the great ironies of biology. The stronger the immune system, the more vulnerable you are to being attacked by it. Why women have more reactive immune systems is a mystery. One theory is that women evolved to have stronger immune systems to fight off infections to protect growing babies. In modern times, this comes at a cost. The increased risk that the body will mistake itself for the invader and then attack, causing autoimmune diseases. The role of hormones in autoimmune diseases. Part of the answer lies in the difference between male and female levels of sex hormones. Sex hormones further amplify this autoimmune, hyperimmune response, which leads to an increased prevalence of autoimmune diseases in women, he says. Estrogen increases immune hyperactivity, while testosterone protects against it. Testosterone is protective. Men have 10 times the amount of testosterone, a hormone that has a protective effect against autoimmune disorders. As a 2021 study published in Gastroenterology suggested, testosterone lowers inflammation, a common symptom of the precursor to autoimmune disorders. Researchers found that by reducing inflammation, testosterone acts as a brake pedal on the immune system. In addition, testosterone reduces the number of B cells, a type of lymphocyte, an immune cell produced by the spleen, that releases harmful antibodies, according to a 2018 study. Women are also more likely to have an increased amount of particular type of B cells, called age-associated B cells, known to increase the autoimmune disease, a 2017 study published in the Journal of Clinical Investigation noted. These cells are found at high rates in autoimmune patients and increase with age. Women also generally live longer than men, which may be another factor. Estrogen increases risk. And it's not just a lack of testosterone that makes women more susceptible to autoimmune diseases, but also higher levels of estrogen. According to a 2019 study published in Arthritis Research and Therapy, researchers found that patients with the highest level of estrogen were the most likely to get scleroderma, an autoimmune disease of connective tissue. This may explain why women in their childbearing years are most likely to experience autoimmune illnesses. Interestingly, it also explains why elderly men with high levels of estrogen were more likely to get severe scleroderma. The researchers noted that women may also be more susceptible to exposure to environmental factors that affect estrogen levels, like endocrine disruptors and estrogen mimics. This increases the risk of autoimmune diseases. It's also genetic. Women may be more susceptible to autoimmune diseases, particularly lupus, at a genetic level, according to a 2019 study published in JCI Insight. There's a molecular twist in skin cells called VGLL3, which appears to trigger an overreaction by the immune system by activating certain genes associated with the immune system, and research discovered that women have far more of these molecules. Treating autoimmune diseases in women. Right now, as women like Amy Paulson have learned, autoimmune diseases can be managed, but not cured. Many more research need to be done into treating these illnesses, particularly in women, says Dr. Shepherd, who calls the gender disparity troubling. This research starts with understanding why autoimmune illnesses affect women more. And with that, let's roll over to Consumer Reports. And let's look at some recalls. Ram pickup trucks. Ram is recalling 272,000 Ram 1500s from 2022 and 23, 2500s from 22 and 24, and 3500s from 22 and 23 pickup trucks because software incompatibility between the vehicle's radio and backup camera could cause the image not to display when in reverse, risking a crash. This also means the vehicle is not in compliance with the federal motor vehicle safety standards. Ram dealers will perform a software update free of charge. Slime liquor candy. Candy Dynamics is recalling about 70 million slime liquor sour rolling liquid candies because the candy's rolling ball can detach, posing a choking hazard. The candies were sold at Five Below, Walmart, and other stores nationwide, and online at Amazon, CandyDynamics.com, and other sites from June 2015 through July 2023 for $2 to $4. Take the candy away from children. Call Candy Dynamics or go to thecandydynamics.com for details to get a full refund for products that are not on empty. I think if they started selling them in 2015, probably most of those are gone already. Honda lawnmowers and pressure washer engines. American Honda Motor is recalling about 400,000 lawnmowers and pressure washer engines because an improperly manufactured part in the engines can cause the starter rope to suddenly retract when pulling to start, posing an injury hazard. The lawnmowers were sold at Ace Hardware, Home Depot, Honda Power Equipment Dealers, Lowe's, Northern Tool, and various farm, agriculture, and rental stores nationwide from May 2022 to June 2023 for $550 to $1,000. Pressure washer engines were sold at Home Depot, Lowe's, and other retail stores nationwide from June 2022 to August 2023 from $370 to $550. Stop using the lawnmowers and pressure washers. Contact an authorized Honda Power Equipment dealer to schedule an appointment for a free inspection and repair. Emporia Smart Plugs. Emporia is recalling about 80,000 of its smart plugs because the smart plugs are not adequately grounded and can pose an electric shock hazard. The smart plugs were sold online at Amazon and shopemporiaenergy.com from July 2022 through May 2023 from $12 to $35. Stop using the smart plug. Call Emporia at 844-367-6742 or go to emporiaenergy.com for details. Emporia will remotely disable the smart plug, and you should then discard it. The smart plug must be connected to the Internet for the remote disabling process to be effective. If you are unable to connect to the Internet to allow the remote disabling process, you may ship the item back to Emporia at no cost. Once the smart plug is disabled or returned, a free replacement or a full refund will be issued. NovaForm Mattresses. FXI is recalling about 48,000 NovaForm Comfort Grand 14-inch and NovaForm DreamAway 8-inch mattresses. Gee, I just saw an ad for those. Because they could have been exposed to water during the manufacturing process, allowing mold to develop and posing a health risk to individuals with compromised immune systems, damaged lungs, or an allergy to mold. The mattresses were sold exclusively at Costco stores in certain states and online at Costco from January 2023 through June 2023 for $150 to $750. Call FXI at 888-886-2057 or go to NovaFormComfort.com for details and to receive a full refund or a free replacement mattress, including free delivery as well as pickup and disposal of the recalled mattress. Generac Portable Generators. Generac is recalling about 64,000 portable generators because the fuel tank can fail to vent adequately, causing pressure to build up, and the tank could expel fuel when open, posing fire and burn hazards. The generators were sold at major home improvement and hardware stores nationwide and on various websites from April 2011 through June 2023 for $3,300 to $3,600. Stop using the generators. Call Generac at 888-391-053 for details and to get a free repair kit. January is the best time to buy smartwatches, sheets and other bedding, ellipticals, and humidifiers. Product update. Why the best place to check blood pressure may be at home. The numbers taken at a doctor's office can be unreliable. Find the most accurate home monitors here and learn how to get your pressure under control. You probably know that high pressure, aka hypertension, is a top risk factor for some most common and deadliest medical emergencies, including heart attacks and strokes. Consistently high pressure can damage the tissue inside your arteries, leading to a plaque buildup and reducing the flow to your heart and brain. But measuring your blood pressure accurately can be tricky. In fact, when you get taken in a doctor's office, there's a good chance those numbers won't reflect your real blood pressure on an ordinary day. Raj Padwal, MD, a professor of medicine at the University of Alberta, who runs a specialty hypertension clinic, says that he generally doesn't ask for in-clinic blood pressure readings for his patients because 50% of the time they're inaccurate. There are a few reasons that readings taken in a doctor's office can be misleading, but the good news is there's an easy, relatively inexpensive way to get an accurate picture of your blood pressure from the comfort of your home. And I'll make a note, there's a common known thing as the pretty nurse blood pressure. That means if you're a male and the nurse happens to be very attractive, it will actually raise your blood pressure a few points. I assume the same side is with women and an attractive doctor. The problem with doctor's office BP checks, or a male nurse, blood pressure is accurately sensitive, changing from moment to moment. It's affected by emotional status, mental health, physical activity, ambient temperature, medications, whether you ate, whether you slept well, and on, said Padwall says. This vital sign is measured with two numbers. Systolic pressure, the top number, which represents the pressure of your arteries as your heart contracts. And the diastolic pressure, the bottom number, which represents the pressure on your arteries when your heart is at rest. Getting an accurate blood pressure reading requires following a highly specific procedure that includes keeping your feet flat on the floor, your back against a sturdy chair, and an arm on a flat surface level with your heart. There's a lot more to it, but you have to go to page 20 for a full rundown, which we will. But many of these requirements aren't consistently met in a doctor's office, where staff may be too rushed to put you in the right position. Plus, doctor's offices can have equipment problems. You might assume that the BP monitors there are more accurate than at-home monitors, but that's often not the case. Analog devices that use a cuff and pressure gauge needs calibration every few months, but this rarely happens, says Jordana Ochoa, MD, an associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine. Digital BP monitors, also used in medical settings, are more reliable, but only a fraction of them have been independently verified for accuracy, a process called validation. Also, your doctor's office may not have the right cuff size for your arm. A too big or too small cuff can result in an inaccurate reading. Some people also experience what's called white coat hypertension, here to mention it, where their blood pressure rises at a doctor's office, presumably due to the stress of a medical visit. Others have master hypertension in which their blood pressure falls to a low level in a doctor's office, possibly because with a lot of stress in their daily lives, feel calmer in a doctor's office. The true prevalence of these conditions isn't clear, but it's thought that 15 to 30% of people have white coat hypertension, and about 32% of those with normal in-office BP readings have masked hypertension. All of this may explain why your blood pressure readings at a doctor's office can vary so much. A 2023 study that evaluated data on more than 500,000 people found that between two consecutive doctor's visits, a person's systolic blood pressure reading changed by an average of 12 mmHg, the unit of measurement for blood pressure, in either direction. That's not a rounding error. When you first start to take a new blood pressure medications, doctors generally expect it to lower your blood pressure by less than 12 millihelograms, says the study's author, Harlan Kummerholtz, MD, a cardiologist and professor of medicine at the Yale School of Medicine. That means if your doctor relies only on an in-office measurements, they can't be sure that the drop in your blood pressure is due to the medications working or something else entirely. Kummerholtz says the only way to overcome this is to collect a lot of measurements, 20 or so, and average them. Fortunately, there's a simple way to help mitigate all of these problems, home blood pressure monitoring. Why home monitoring works so well? When you measure at home, you can buy a high-quality monitor with a cuff that fits your arm. You can also be sure to prepare properly and use the correct procedure. And you can take multiple measurements on different days and provide that data to your doctor. Monitoring blood pressure at home is especially valuable for anyone whose in-office readings indicate high blood pressure, and for those who are at an elevated risk for heart disease because of pre-existing health conditions like diabetes. Padwell says it can also be useful for tracking the effect of a new medication or an adjusted dosage, or for people who are pregnant or postpartum and should be on the lookout for a severe form of high blood pressure called preeclampsia. And not only can home monitoring be more accurate than in-office checks, but some studies have found that it can actually help you control your blood pressure, particularly in the first few months of using a monitor. Choosing a blood pressure monitor. Buying an accurate home blood pressure monitor is key. While most manufacturers haven't published some results of any accuracy testing, some medical groups have compiled lists of devices that have been validated by independent experts. I'm sorry, I lost my line there. All of the experts we talked with recommended the American Medical Association's U.S. Blood Pressure's validated device listing, validatebp.org, as a good starting point when shopping for a home monitor. SEER also rates BP monitors. Our accuracy tests, which we pattern after industry standards, involve comparing each monitor's reading with results from the gold standard, a device called a Mercury. This is spelled SPHYGMMOMANOMETER, Sphygmomanometer. We also evaluate each monitor's ease of use and comfort. That was a heck of a word. Home blood pressure monitors come in two main varieties, those that are placed on your upper arm and those that go on your wrist. In general, experts in CR recommend arm monitors, which tend to be more accurate because there's less room for error in how they're positioned. But using correct arm cuff solve is crucial in getting accurate readings, and some people with larger arm circumferences may not be able to find an arm monitor with an appropriate cuff size. In those cases, wrist monitors can be a good alternative. You'll just need to be extra careful to position them correctly. None of the wrist monitors in CR tests scored high enough to earn our recommendation, but several still earned a good accuracy score. You may wonder if an alternative to buying your own blood pressure monitor is a used blood pressure kiosk in your pharmacy. But Padwell says very few public blood pressure kiosks have been validated by independent experts. Plus, it might be challenging to follow guidelines for taking blood pressure correctly when you're in the middle of a busy pharmacy. Got high blood pressure? Read this. High blood pressure usually has no symptoms, so people taking medications for it may not see immediate benefits. That makes it hard for many to stick with their meds, Kermholtz notes. But the treatments for hypertension, including both medications and lifestyle changes, can successfully lower your blood pressure. Work with your doctor to find the strategy that works best for you. Here's what to consider. Try the DASH diet. The dietary approaches to hypertension, or DASH, is an eating plan that can help lower your blood pressure and your LDL cholesterol, another risk factor for cardiovascular disease. Rigorous studies have shown that people who followed the DASH plan had lower blood pressure levels at the end of several weeks than people who followed more typical American diets. The DASH diet offers a lot of flexibility and is based on a few simple principles. Eating lots of fruits, vegetables, whole grains, fish, poultry, beans, nuts, seeds, vegetable oils, and low-fat dairy. Limiting sources of saturated fats like fatty meats and full-fat dairy, as well as sweets and sugary beverages. Reducing salt in the diet is also key. When you take in more salt, your body retains more water, which can raise your blood pressure. Keep in mind that most of our dietary sodium comes not from homemade food, but from processed food and restaurant meals. So focus on reducing those rather than forcing yourself to underseason the food you cook. Aim for 30 minutes of exercise 5 days a week. Regular physical activity helps control blood pressure and reduces your risk of other problems, including heart attacks and strokes, diabetes, and even some cancers. An analysis published in 2023 in the British Journal of Sports Medicine evaluated 270 randomized controlled trials to find out if certain types of exercise were better for controlling blood pressure. Many different types were helpful, the study showed, so pick whatever form you enjoy. But it found the most benefits come from isometric wall squats, sometimes called wall sits, so considering adding those to your routine. Consider other lifestyle changes. Smoking doesn't just increase the risk of lung cancer. It also temporarily raises blood pressure and contributes to the long-term buildup of plaque and arteries. Drinking alcohol is also linked to a greater risk of hypertension. Experts recommend limiting your intake to one drink per day for women and two for men. And public health experts also recommend maintaining a healthy weight or losing weight if you need to, as another strategy for managing or preventing high blood pressure. Talk to your doctor about meds. A variety of medications are available for controlling blood pressure, including diuretics, ACE inhibitors, calcium, channel blockers, and angiotensin receptor blockers. You may need to try a few different drugs or a combination of them to find what's effective for you, Krumholtz said. When to start on meds depends on several factors, but doctors generally begin considering them if your blood pressure is 130 over 80, and they're quicker to recommend than if higher it gets from there. Can smartwatches measure blood pressure? Wonder if you could skip the home monitor and just measure your blood pressure with a smartwatch or fitness tracker? At least today, that's not a good option. Devices from major brands like Apple and Fitbit don't offer that. While Samsung devices do have the capability, the service isn't available in the U.S. yet. Still, you can find some cheap fitness trackers online that companies claim can measure BP. Best to avoid relying on such measurements for now, says Jordana Cohen, MD and associate professor at the University of Pennsylvania Perlman School of Medicine. The only kinds of blood pressure monitors that are validated for accuracy, and the only ones in our ratings, are those that have an inflating cuff that tightens and relaxes around your arm or wrist, which allows the device to directly sense the pressure being exerted on your arteries by your blood. Wearables use a different technique, generally using optical sensors to estimate blood pressure. The catch: These usually require regular measurements with a cuff device for calibration. And as the research has found with pulse oximeters, this optical technology is sometimes inaccurate with people with darker skin. How to get an accurate reading? Prepare. Check that the cuff you have is the correct size. Monitors will specify a range of arm circumferences. Make sure you don't exercise, smoke, or have anything to eat or drink, especially caffeine, in 30 minutes before you measure. Empty your bladder. Sit quietly without talking for 5 minutes before taking and during a reading. Time it right. It is important to test at the same time of day each day. Follow your doctor's advice on how infrequently you should check your blood pressure. For most expert people, experts often recommend taking 2 readings in the morning and 2 in the evening each day. Your feet should be flat on the floor. Relax your hand and wrist. The arm that has the cuff should be supported on a hard, flat surface like a table. The cuff should be level with your heart. Don't talk while taking a reading. Don't just roll up a long sleeve, as this can affect the reading. Wear a short sleeve shirt. A BP cuff should be on your bare skin. Sit in a supportive chair with a rigid back, not a sofa. Wrist monitor basics. Lifting your arm or resting it against your chest are both valid methods for getting an accurate reading from a wrist monitor. The key? Make sure the monitor is level with your heart. Check your device's instructions and keep your hand relaxed and wrist in a neutral position. Understand your numbers. And then it shows you want to have your hand just relaxed. It shows it at a fist, and that's a negative. It shows bent backwards or bent forward. That's a negative, too. Understanding your numbers. Guidelines from experts group define normal blood pressure at less than 120 over 80. But you don't become a candidate for meds until you reach stage 1 or stage 2 of hypertension. Normal, systolic less than 120 and diastolic less than 80. Elevated, 120 to 129 and diastolic less than 80. High blood pressure, stage 1, 130 to 139 and 80 over 89. High blood pressure stage 2, 140 systolic, 90 or more diastolic. Hypertensive, crisis, a medical emergency, higher than 180, and diastolic higher than 120, and or diastolic higher than 120. And many of these devices are priced at $100 or less and give you a control you need to get accurate blood pressure readings. Some can even store readings for you and a partner. Arm monitors. Omron Platinum, BP 5450, $79. Omicron Silver, BP 5250, $85. Omicron 10 Series, BP 7450, scored at 84, it's $92. Omicron Evolve, BP 7000, $110. You get the idea that Omron is the best thing? AD Medical, UA 76, at $52. And Omron Series 3, BP 7100, at $50. And the wrist monitors, the Omron again wins the ball game. The Series 7 BP 6030 at $65. The Equate from Walmart 4500 series at $40. The Omron Gold BP 4350 at $65, and that comes from Amazon. The Omron 3 series BP 6100 at $55. And that is the best of the ratings, and that's not a bad thing. There's a picture of a cute doggy with a cone around its head. And the headlines is, should you get pet insurance? Vet fees are rising. Is pet coverage worth the monthly cost? We've got answers, plus ratings of insurance companies. Despite having, and this is by Brian Vine, shown with his cat Phoebe, his deputy editor in special products projects at Consumer Reports. Vet fees are rising. Despite having both a dog and a cat, my household pet insurance has long been on a maybe-we-should-look-into-it list, along with getting faster internet. But our lassitude was called into question early one evening when Phoebe, our 3-year-old cat, showed up the back door disoriented, limping, and with a nickel-sized bald spot on her left hind quarter. I was concerned, but also worried things were about to get expensive. Turns out most of the tens of millions of cat or dog-owning houses in the U.S. don't insure them either. According to North American Pet Health Insurance Association, in 2022, just 4.8 million cats and dogs were insured in this country. In a first-ever evaluation for Consumer Reports, we rated eight pet insurers, either according to the North American Pet Health Insurance Association, Oh, ASPCA, Banfield, Embrace, Fetch, Healthy Paws, Nationwide Pet Insurance, Pets Best, Trupanion, based on a survey of 2,061 CR members with insured pets. What we found, many pet owners aren't too happy with their coverage. Of the 8 pest insurance providers we looked at, 6 earned a middling score for overall satisfaction, and 2 bottomed out with unfavorable ratings. To be sure, pet coverage is a mixed breed. Oh, that's terrible. It has some similarities to human health insurance because the majority of plans have premiums, deductibles, and copays. But pet policies vary more in what they will cover or won't, with not all pet insurance covering the same suite of possible veterinary needs in their basic packages. Because of this, pet insurance can be complicated from a comparison shopping point of view. For example, the plan Trupanion offers covers illness, injury, surgery, hospital stays, medication, and advanced dentistry. But Liberty Mutual, which was not in our survey, is more a la carte, offering plans that cover only accidental injuries or only accidents or illness, or ones that cover all plus wellness preventive care. Banfield Pet Hospital plans, which are more like veterinary flexible spending account, cover wellness care only. Shopping for coverage. If you're thinking about getting pet insurance, there are a number of considerations to weigh. What the plans cover, what they cost, and how well they are reimbursed. In addition, there are other important aspects of pet insurance to know about. Pre-existing conditions are typically not covered. A pre-existing condition is any illness or injury that predates the start of an insurance policy, classified as incurable like cancer or diabetes, or curable like a broken bone. Insurers may ask to see your pet's medical records before enrollment, or they may impose waiting periods up to 12 months before coverage starts. There are age cutoffs, too. While a pet's age factors into the price of the premium, some companies will not extend new policies to pets over a certain age. Of the 8 carriers ranked by CR, only 4, ASPCA, Banfield, Fetch, and Pets Best, have no age limits. Major Medical Nationwide is restricted to dogs 10 years old and younger, and the other carriers have age policies that vary depending on the type of coverage. The cost of premiums, copays, and deductibles can add up. The premium price is based on the type of coverage you choose, where you live, the kind of pet you have, and its age. In our survey, the typical premium cost was $47 per month per pet. Trupanion was highest at $63 a month, and Pets Best was lowest at $42. A small difference, but one that comes to roughly $252 a year, depending on the plan you choose. Deductibles can range from $0 to $1,000 or more, and copays, the fixed percentage of vet bill you must pay out of pocket, are typically 20%. There are usually annual caps. Pet insurers typically impose annual limits on how much they will pay out on an individual animal's coverage. If you hit your animal limit, it will be your responsibility to pay out of pocket for the vet care. With ASPCA, you can choose annual caps ranging from $2,500 to unlimited. Nationwide gives you the option of electing annual maximum of $5,000, $7,500, $10,000, and even unlimited, depending on the plan. You typically need to pay providers directly, then get reimbursed. This means you must have the ability to pay the vet bill at the point of service and then file a claim for reimbursement with the insurance company. Insurers that reimburse the most, more than half, 55% of CR's reimbursement for the most recent claim submitted over the past 12 months. An additional 21% received partial reimbursement. Embrace Pet Insurance delivered the highest level of complete reimbursements, paying in full on 86% of claims, followed by Banfield at 84%, Trupanion at 79%, but Pets Best and Nationwide Pet Insurance have paid less likely to fully reimburse on most recent claims, with 63% and 61% reimbursement rates, respectively. Most plans let you choose your vet, but some practice charges higher prices than others. It's important to ask for a price list and be mindful of your coverage limits. You will be reimbursed according to your policy's terms, no matter which vet you go to. Banfield's Pet Hospital Wellness Plans coverage is a notable exception to the Any Vet rule. Its policyholders must select a provider from Banfield's network of 3,600-plus veterinarians. Will pet insurance save you money? According to CR's analysis of responsible respondents' claim experience, getting pet insurance doesn't guarantee you'll save money. The typical survey respondent paid on an average $47 a month for coverage, $564 a year. The average respondent submitted claims for about $786 for vet services yearly, but according to our estimates, likely received reimbursements of between $500 to $600. because he also paid a deductible on copays. In the end, most respondents pretty much broke even. Those who got wellness care coverage, which includes a pet's annual visit with vaccines, etc., could save a little if they were also by major medical coverage, according to the ASPCA. The annual cost of routine wellness care for a dog is $225, with the riders for this coverage raise the premium you're already paying by $120 to $300 difference. And what's the rating on these things? Pets Best got a 55 out of the rating. Embrace got a 52. Trupanion got a 52. Healthy Paws got a 51. ASPA got a 43. Nationwide got a 42. Fetch got a 38. And Banfield got a 35. So needless to say, it ain't exactly a good thing. Acquiring pet insurance may require you to take stock of both your emotional and financial reserves. For some, the decision will come down to simple math, while others may conclude that buying insurance is the right choice for the peace of mind it provides. For now, I'm pursuing a hybrid route. When Phoebe was injured, we opted for the $25 consult from a vet telehealth service that offered 5 days of unlimited vet access via text and video conference. With the consult, medicine, and supplies, we spent $133 to get Phoebe on the mend. Bond Vet and POP, P-A-W-P, are two pet health telehealth options. Another way to save vet care is to use a veterinary teaching hospital, which may be able to offer discounts on care. The American Association of Veterinary Medical Colleges suggests contacting its members' institutions to learn about specific services. The cost to insure these breeds. Premiums are based on your occasion and your thing. The most experienced is a Rottweiler. English Bulldog is next. Doberman Pinscher follows that. French Bulldog and the Boxer are next. The least expensive are the Beagle, the German Short-Haired Pointer, the Dachshund, the Australian Shepherd, and the Yorkshire Terrier. And all of those are at least $50 to $125. Next time you see a pigeon, salute. That's because pigeons have been awarded Britain's Dickon Medal, honoring bravery by animals in wartime. More than any other creature, at least 60 animals have received the award, including 18 dogs, 3 horses, and a cat. Pigeons, however, received the medal 32 times. Not to say that the Air Force looks down its nose at Army types, but at a gathering of our half-Army and half-Air Force Global Strike Command unit, the Air Force sergeant dismissed us by saying, "Be back here at 14 hours. For you Army guys, that's when the little hand is on the 2 and the big hand is on the 12. I reported for medical duty at Capodito Naval Air Station in Italy soon after commercial jet. Oops, we're going to not be able to finish that. We're going to run out of time. Sorry about that. I'll do that next week. Sorry about that, faux pas. We have run out of time for today's episode of Reader's Digest and Consumer Reports. Be sure to listen in next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. I'm Jim Cronin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. So long until next week, and thanks so much for listening.